Recording.
Oh, one second.
No, it's too late.
Okay.
No.
Is it actually too late?
Yes.
Okay. Hi, people.
Well, what do you need to do?
Oh, I was just going to ask if we wanted to do that correction from last week.
Oh, yeah, we can talk about it. Yeah, sure.
Okay, cool.
Okay. Recording.
Hi, I'm Thomas Smith of Serious Inquiries Only, and I took a left at the valley.
I know we shouldn't have to scream that we're atheists, you know, we don't have non-astrologers and all that, but with the religious people taking over the world, I mean, we can either speak up or be pushed into a corner.
I'm proud to be an atheist, a skeptic, a non-believer, an infidel, a heathen, I call it how I see it. You just call it faith in unsubstantiated claims. That's something to be ashamed. I'm an atheist. I'm an atheist.
Coming at you from Santa's Secret Shop, this is Left of the Valley. My name is Kevin, and I noticed that this year, I stopped believing in Santa is roughly the same time I started getting ugly socks instead of cool stuff for Christmas.
Hey, ugly socks are the best.
Joining me as usual are the fill-ins for Santa's Reindeers team. She summarized that Santa should drop the reindeers and ride a Holly Davidson instead, Nancy.
That sounds good to me, and a tattoo.
She took her ex to the Christmas market. Unfortunately, no one bought her. Christy.
I wanted some good money, okay?
And she says it's the fifth year in a row the in-laws came over for Christmas. Maybe she'll let him in this time. Kirsten.
Nah, there's no hope for that one.
Nope, they're not coming.
Guys, welcome back.
Hello.
Our Christmas special.
It's going to be fun. I'm so excited.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Indeed.
Happy holidays.
Indeed. That's going to be fun. Nancy's still adjusting her volume, but that's okay.
Well, hey, for once, it's not me.
Yeah.
So today we're going to do a fairly light show. We're just going to be talking, we're going to try to keep it positive as much as possible and talk about Christmas and all the wonderful stuff about Christmas and wonderful stories about Christmas. But first, the news never stops, so let's do a bit of chit-chat. Did you guys hear that the grizzly bear hunt has been banned in BC now?
About time.
Yeah.
I didn't know there was a grizzly bear hunt.
Actually, it's been a huge controversy for years now. The environmentalists have been fighting against it to keep this from happening, obviously. Now the NDP government has decided that it was no longer acceptable in the public's eye to have this. And maybe they've done it as a move to appease the green vote, especially in light of them going ahead with the Site C dam.
Yeah.
So the BC Forest Minister Doug Donaldson basically went to this. So you're no longer allowed to hunt grizzly bears, except for First Nations, of course. It's estimated there's about 15,000 grizzly bears in BC. And 1,700 permits were issued in 2017, and about 300 bears are killed every year.
Well, when they're killed by hunters, are they killed for? They're not killed for meat. Why are they?
No, they're killed.
They're hunted just for trophy.
Mostly, yes.
And to put up their stuffed bodies in front of some thrift shop.
Something like that, yeah. Something like that.
Will this impact the amount? Like, I didn't know. Like, was the a permit issued at all to do with, keeping the population, down?
Well, that's what some of the hunters are claiming. You know, there is a bit of a theory that if you take care and you manage the apex predator in a population, in an ecosystem, it manages to keep everything underneath working well. I'm not sure if this was actually necessary. And, of course, there was a pretty good source of revenue as well for these guides,
yeah.
You know, to have these trophy hunters from outside of the province, inside the provinces, and from the states as well to come up and shoot a bear. But now the government is basically saying the tourism to actually see the bears is actually going to be more better for the coffers of the government.
How is there tourism to see the bears?
No, but you can actually, you know, it's a bit like...
I wouldn't want to get close to a grizzly bear.
Well, you don't get right close to it, but it's a bit like watching the whales, you know. You go sightseeing as well, and you could catch whales on the ocean, but you can kind of do the same thing with bears.
Yeah, but whales aren't going to try to eat you.
No, but you could do it from safe places, right?
True.
You're not on the ground 300 yards away from a bear and say, hey, how you doing? You know, no, it doesn't really work that way. So anyway, it's going to be interesting to keep an eye on that.
That's good. I think that's the logical, good, it's common sense and it's kindness and it's all kinds of good things. I don't think there's a bad, there's a downside to that at all. So.
No, I don't think so either. I mean, I can understand you want to hunt or something like that, but you know what? It's... Why don't you hunt with a camera instead?
That keeps the Trump boys out of Canada.
yeah, there we go. That's a plus right there.
Hey, all they had to do was to put that in the bill.
Keep the Trump family away. There we go. We're good. We talked about last week and the week before about how Trump decided to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Well, the UN decided to vote on that, and they basically, all of them, decided no. We're not doing this. And
I think it was
the
nine
U.S.
countries that voted with them.
Sorry,
I think it was nine countries that voted with them.
I'm not even sure some of them did. I mean, maybe under pressure from the U.S.
Yeah, well, a lot of them were countries that get aid from the States.
Yeah, of course.
See, I think there were 14 countries on the side of the U.S. and 35 abstentions, but 128 or 138,
something like that.
Yeah, and so, Nikki Haley's taking names.
That's right. That's what I was about to say. You know, they decided to take notes. And Trump is threatening to cut aid to the countries not voting with the U.S., saving billions of dollars. You figure at some point the Americans are going to realize they are not the center of the universe? I mean, Toronto is obviously.
There's no reason to be surprised at this point. If you're surprised at anything he says, you're either hibernating someplace or, not listening.
Yeah.
But for him to actually say, with all the money that we give to this institution, and then they turn around and vote against us. Well, what the heck do you think the UN is there for if not to censure countries that are not in agreement with all the principles of the UN, for heaven's sake? And it's not binding. It's not like they're coming over here, sitting in his office and poking him and telling him how terrible he is. I mean, it's just, but... It's money with that man. It's just money.
Oh, it absolutely is just that. And it's kind of funny because if that same vote would have arisen 20 years ago under a different president, I think a lot of countries might have joined the U.S., but I think it's almost like the entire world is saying, you know what, U.S., you need to sit down and take a break here. You need to really rethink what you're doing because we're not agreeing with you, and we're not intimidated by you.
I'm sure they, part of it was that it was a warning, to think before you speak, now that you're an authoritarian leader, but I don't think it's going to make any difference. I understand that Nikki did issue invitations for a little party for everybody that vote. That seems more like a punishment, though, don't it? You voted for us, now you got to come and, play
spend
nice to
us.
to the big guy. Oh. There's no winning.
I think Trump, when he heard growing up that America was like the leader of the free world, he thought like, oh, if I become president, I'm literally going to be leading the world.
I think so. That man, we'll be talking about this man for decades
ever.
To come.
Yep.
Speaking of the U.S., do you guys see that the U.S. passed their tax bill?
Oh, yes. Has it actually been signed by President Trump yet?
I don't know if it's been signed.
Signed yesterday.
Oh, it was signed yesterday?
Yeah, he called early in the morning and said to his staff, I promised everybody I'd do this for Christmas. So he rushed everybody to get the bill to him without any of the Senate or any of the – so they aren't getting any of the credit or any of the FaceTime that they deserve. And he had a box full of pens that should have gone to the Congress, because they were the ones that signed it. They had the ceremony. No, he just said, here, I've got all these pens and gave them all out to the press.
What?
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Merry Christmas.
Merry
Christmas, Congress. Go ahead. Stay behind Trump.
So this is $1.5 trillion tax bill. It's the largest change on the tax code for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
Senator Sanders, that we love, forced a second vote because after he found some irregularities in the bill. So it seems that trickle-down economics is back in the U.S.
Yeah.
Reaganomics. So the corporate tax will go down from 35% to 21%.
Yeah.
Who's going to pay for that?
everyone else.
The average Joe.
The people exactly. are going to pay for that are the children who are whose parents are going to lose their health care
yeah.
benefits and be forced to pay higher premiums and eventually have to pay more mm-hmm. in their taxes and not get any raises because the money that the corporate people save in taxes are going to go right into their bonuses. So who's going to pay for it? Everybody who deserves to have had the tax yep. break in the first place.
Exactly.
It's interesting.
Other than that, I'm perfectly fine with it.
there's a few companies that are giving out like Christmas bonuses. And a lot of the Republicans are pointing that, like, oh, look at this tax bill. Look at they're giving this money out. But it's like, actually, they were already planning to do that for, like, a month.
Yeah.
Like, your tax bill isn't the reason this is happening.
I know. It's they don't seem to understand that, even if you give a tax break to a rich man, there's only so many cars he can buy. But if you give a tax break to his 30 employees, they might buy 30 cars.
But they might also go and buy maybe some ice cream.
They'll get rid of their debt and they'll spend the money instead of stashing it.
They will go back into the local economy.
Exactly.
Because people who don't have extra cash don't put it into their trillions of dollars in savings. It has to go into their monthly expenses. But people who already have $1 billion or even just $1 million who already have their rent and food and everything cost fixed, like, because that doesn't change. Like, when you're living in a mansion, you still have the same food costs.
Exactly.
You still eat the same amount. So all this extra money is just going into their funds where it can get stored and create more money.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think I'll go and buy a new Lambo. Yeah. Maybe a Ferrari.
Exactly. When you got a couple of $1 billion stashed in the bank there, it's a tax break. It's great. Yeah. But, I mean, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't go back into the economy. Yeah.
You're assuming that they should care about the low and middle class. Bad assumption.
Yeah.
Kevin, bad assumption.
Did you guys also hear about this little tragedy? In Washington State, south of Seattle, there was an Amtrak train that derailed.
It did, yes.
The train was going 80 kilometers above the speed limit it was supposed to.
Is it kilometers or miles?
80 kilometers an hour above the speed limit. So it was doing 128 and a 48 zone.
Oh, okay.
So this was the inaugural route of they were supposed to do a route that was faster from going to Portland to Seattle and up and down the coast there. 8 dead and 200 injured.
That's insane.
I don't think is that the new numbers? I didn't think there were that many people on the train.
That were injured? Oh yeah, there was a fair amount. I mean, 200 people goes by pretty fast. I mean, I could be wrong here, but that's the article I read. That's what I saw. Mm. So if I'm wrong,
whatever.
Please let
me
know.
It's a tragedy, and I think part of it had to do with the what they call it, the positive control or mm-hmm. whatever it is mm-hmm. that it wasn't activated.
Yeah.
It's a maiden run, and it wasn't activated.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether it was engineer error. And then the safety factors didn't kick in or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But it was awful to see that.
It was kind of like on an overpass, and then it just kind of fell right down and it was dangling there.
Yeah.
I was like, wow.
It's amazing people survived, with as few, not as few injuries, but, not worse injuries.
Yeah, it could have been way worse. Yeah. It absolutely could have been way worse. And I got to point out a little something. Our friend Chris Christensen, it's his birthday today.
Happy birthday.
Whether or not he's listening to us or will listen to the show, happy birthday. Our favorite Christian apologist.
Yeah.
So it's his birthday.
He gets a workout with us, which is good.
Oh, yeah. I think we should bring him on. We should bring him on soon enough.
We'll
have a conversation with a Christian.
Oh, I'm sure we will.
We could just pound him into the ground. Yeah. Let's do that.
He usually comes on once a year.
Yeah, last time he came with a debate against Tyler on the history of
Jesus. And then it takes 364 days for him to
to recover. And Christina, you wanted to point out a little factual mistake that we made on a report we did last week.
Yes,
right?
It was with the news report that the Trump administration had censored the CDC,
mm-hmm.
And that they had banned specific words.
Yep.
And it was later reported that it wasn't actually that these words were banned. It was just that in the CDC's request for finances, they were like, okay, we shouldn't use these words kind of as to make it more likely that they would actually get their funding. because they kind of knew that these words were would make the Trump administration less likely to give them money. Which is still
horrible. It's still sad. It's still sad as hell. Yeah.
But it wasn't that the Trump administration was like, you cannot use these words.
From now on, the CDC cannot use science-based because they might not get funding.
Yeah, so it was more of an internal decision.
Yeah.
It's playing to the base. You know, we're anything having to do with science or an understanding of the real world and how people, you know, actually live their lives.
It's really worrying that when you realize that the CDC doesn't just like automatically get funding. I'm like, they're kind of important.
Like you would think you would want to fund that.
Yeah,
you would think so. All right. So today we're going to be doing some nice Christmas stories and stuff like that. So I'm going to put on a virtual campfire here.
Okay.
A bit of Christmas music.
We need one today. It's chilly outside.
Yes. Because we're in Canada. Yeah. And there is snow outside.
Can you guys hear this? Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Some nice soothing Christmas music. Crackling fire.
Get our hot chocolate with marshmallows.
That's right.
Although, thankfully, not as much snow as last year.
Oh, God.
Hold on. It just started.
It's supposed to be as bad as last year. We had feet in November.
Yeah.
This is the one spot in the country that we barely get any snow and you're complaining.
Yes. I don't like snow.
Gotta get it on.
I like rain. Lots and lots of rain. Not snow.
All right. My dear Nancy, you had a few things you wanted to talk about.
I do.
Okay.
I do. And to start this segment off, which is going to be fun, Mr. Kevin, if you would play the three little clips that I think will be fun for everybody to listen to, we'll start off with a little music.
Classic.
Okay,
I might break out to be singing.
All right, and the next one is.
This is Tony Bennett.
Bells ring. Are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight. We're happy tonight. Walking in a winter wonderland.
Winter wonderland. Gone is always a favorite. Yeah, let's do the last one.
Let's do the last one. Okay. This one's a bit more hip hoppy.
Hip, hip, hip.
Jackson 5.
So here's the pop quiz.
haven't
had a pop quiz in a long time. All right, Winter Wonderland, White Christmas, Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Other than the fact that they're all Christmas songs, what else do they have in common?
They were all written about the same place.
They all what?
They're all written about the same place.
Let's count that as a sort of a good guess.
Okay.
Okay.
What else do we have in common?
What else do they have in common?
They're all sung by men. They're all sung by men.
They're all sung by men, but they don't necessarily have to be.
They all have the same writer.
No, they don't have the same writer, but I'm going to give you sort of a half a cigar for that one, because they're being all Christmas songs, they're all written by Jewish composers.
Oh, cool.
I know. Most of us don't realize that the most popular songs, and I'll tell you what they are in a minute, but most of the popular Christmas songs were all written by nice Jewish composers. During the 30s and 40s, the standards that we have now are all written by Jewish
artists. Isn't that interesting?
And that's pretty awesome.
Most people aren't aware of how influential the Jewish songwriters were, and they were all not all of them, but most of the big writers were big writers of songs that were patriotic or had to do with holidays. Mm-hmm. And most of them, of course, the Jewish, I mean, the Jewish, it's like a Jewish Christmas. So here's a list of some of the popular songs. And everybody's going to go, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't either with some of these. Winter Wonderland, which we heard. Have Yourself a Merry Little
Such
Christmas.
Such a good song.
Santa Claus is Coming to Town, which we heard. Mm-hmm. Let It Snow, Let It Snow, Let
Beautiful.
It Snow. The Most Wonderful Time of the Year.
Yes.
Which we don't hear all that often anymore, but it's a nice one. Do You Know It's Christmas? Sleigh Ride. The White Christmas, by the way, was written by Irving Berlin, who also wrote Easter Parade and God Bless America. He was the most prolific of all of the songwriters we've ever heard. And there's a cute story about Irving Berlin, who, as you know, did a lot of movie songs and a lot of songs for Broadway. And during World War II, when he became really popular, nobody knew what he looked like because there wasn't, you know, an instant pictures of him anyplace. And he wasn't in many, many movies. And he was on a train traveling from one place to another, and there were a lot of servicemen on the train. And he was a great showman, and he decided he'd entertain them all with singing. And so he did. He sang a lot of songs, and somebody came over to him and complimented him and said, wow, you sure are great because you know all those popular songs. How do you know them? And he said, I wrote them.
That's a good comeback.
Yeah, which is kind of funny. Also, there's the Christmas Waltz, Silver Bells.
Oh, I love Silver Bells.
Oh, hold on.
Santa Baby, which was...
Oh, I hate that song so much.
Yeah.
I hate it.
You hate it?
I hate that song.
Oh, yeah.
I kind of want to play it now. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I had to sing it in high school.
Yeah.
It
I'll
was
Be
not
Home
fun.
For Christmas, which
that
was one
is
that
amazing.
Was written for the servicemen in particular. I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm.
Aww.
And the Christmas song, Chestnuts Roasting by an Open Fire. Okay, that was a great, the Christmas song, Chestnuts which starts Chestnuts Roasting by an Open Fire, was written by one of the great jazz singers of all time, and you guys may be too young to realize who Mel Torme
Oh,
was.
I know Mel Torme.
You
know,
Mel Torme?
I don't know.
Nope.
Mel Torme was born in Chicago, and he was known as the Velvet Fog because his voice was so smooth, and he had perfect pitch, but he was also, he could sing a ballad, and he could also sing jazz, and he became more famous for jazz as he grew older. And one of the things he did in Chicago while he was growing up, and in his teens and becoming a little bit more popular but trying to establish a career, was to appear at many of the movie theaters. Back in the 40s, when you went to see a movie at any of the larger theaters, if they were downtown or in bigger neighborhoods, they'd have intermission and they'd have a show. And they'd have some musical artist, a singer or whatever. And Mel Torme would go, you know, to the larger theaters and sing with the band.
Nice.
And I saw him at one of those shows. But you know, who knew who Mel Torme was then? But yeah, he was very, very popular in Chicago.
You know, and as a child, my parents used to watch this sitcom called Night Court. It was very popular. It was very funny. And Mel Torme would make guest appearances on that show on a regular basis. Now, one of the main characters, the judge in that show, is a huge fan of Mel Torme. Of course, me as a kid, I don't know nothing. I don't know nothing about music. So I thought Mel Torme was just a favorite of my parents' generation. So one of the first Christmas presents I bought him was a tape or something like that from Mel Torme. And he had no idea who this was. Mel Torme.
Oh, my gosh.
But this is even before their generation, right? Mel Torme was way back there.
Yeah, it was. So, what's your favorite Christmas song?
Oh, it's got to be Santa Baby, right?
Santa
that's
Baby?
The one you got.
Yeah.
I Will Murder You.
Oh, Kevin, no.
Why are you doing this to me?
Please tell me at least.
I can torture you guys. I have the board. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, my gosh.
Christina, what's your favorite?
Oh, my gosh, there's so many. Okay, so I grew up very religious. And I didn't realize there was music other than Christmas music until I was about nine.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I love Christmas music, like all Christmas music except that one that you just played. Like literally that's the only Christmas song I don't like. Oh my gosh, there are so many. Probably O Holy Night. Or no. O Come, O Come, Emmanuel.
This might take a while.
Your traditional Christmas carol.
By Enya. Ah. It's so amazing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Kirsten.
I thought you wanted a hippopotamus for Christmas.
Yeah. Okay, that is amazing as well.
That is just our generation.
Yeah. That's.
I want a hippopotamus for Christmas.
I sing along, but I don't want to hurt people's ears.
Yeah.
Don't hurt an audience.
I don't know who wrote that. Probably a nice Jewish guy someplace.
An animal lover.
Probably. I think some of the ones, especially I love it when they come on at work, is like Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer is so humorous. This one, it's more of a country one, but it's Santa's Got a Choo-Choo Train.
Oh,
God. Oh, I don't have these things.
That's a cute one. Yeah.
Have something a bit more mainstream.
Yeah. My favorite is Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. And I don't know why it's the minor key that does it. But every time I hear that song, and I could listen to it forever, that's the one song that really affects me. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful song.
Yeah, I have this Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas by Diana Krall. That's what's
beautiful.
So the most popular Christmas song is White Christmas, which was introduced in Holiday Inn by Bing Crosby, and it became instantly popular. And even today, even though that song, is in the 40s, it's still the top seller.
Really?
Any idea what the second top seller is?
Let me guess. All I Want for Christmas
From
Is You.
Now on.
Good guess. Kevin's going to play it in a minute.
Okay.
Oh, so I know the answer to that.
Okay, yeah. Okay, Kevin, play the second most popular song.
Hold on, I
got to
find it here because now I went all over the place.
Good job.
Here it is. Well, this is the Ringo Starr version.
Okay.
So you got to give it a minute.
Oh, okay.
Makes sense now, doesn't it?
Okay, I get it. This is a pretty great Christmas song.
And it's one of Nancy's least favorite songs.
It may be one of the least favorite. However, it has the most interesting story attached to it. And I think it has the most interesting background altogether because it started off as a book and then it became a song.
Really?
And then it became an animated and then it became and it became and it became. So in every incarnation, it has still remained extremely popular. And kids just love it.
Everyone
and most kids today don't realize that Rudolph was added later, in the 30s. They thought that it came with the original A Visit from St. Nicholas, with the Dasher and Dancer. And
which
all
are all girls, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they are.
Indeed.
Well, you think they are. Some of them have been interpreted as male. So we won't
transgender deers.
So here's the story. Yeah, here's the story. And speaking of Mel Torme and Chicago, this is another Chicago. I was born in Chicago. Maybe that's why I'm 3,000 years old because something has to do with Chicago. So here's the story. Back in 1939, Montgomery Ward, which was a rival of Sears, was a big catalog company and a department store. Brick-and-mortar department store as well. And every year at Christmas, they gave out little books to the children that would come to visit Santa Claus in their stores. And they finally realized that if they made their own book, that they wouldn't have to pay the money and royalties and whatever else it was to the publishers. So they had a guy in their copywriting department whose name was Robert May, and they said, okay, Bob, it's up to you. We want you to do a little coloring book, and you can have it anything you want, but it should be a little Christmas theme of some kind. So he took it on, And he was really, May was going through a really bad time. His wife was dying of cancer. He had a little four-year-old daughter, and he's trying to figure out, what do I do to make children happy? And all the time, he's going through a pretty tough time in his life. So he knew that his daughter really liked deer and reindeer. So he took her to the zoo, and he decided, okay, he's going to make the story about a deer or a reindeer of some kind. And he settled on a reindeer, and then it was who he was, what name he was going to give it. And he thought of Rollo, and they thought of a lot of different names with ours. And he finally figured, okay, it's going to be Rudolph. His daughter liked that name, and so he named it Rudolph. So as he was writing the lyrics, but as he was writing the story about Rudolph, he decided to put it in verse because he liked it, and he thought his daughter would be amused by it. And he began to think about the character of Rudolph and his own background. Now, Robert May was Jewish. He didn't always want people to know that, and it changed a little bit in terms of how he presented himself later in life. But he and his wife and his daughter, Barbara, were Jewish. And Robert May had a pretty tough time when he was growing up, being bullied by other kids because he was Jewish. And so the character of Rudolph took on a little bit of what Robert had experienced. All the reindeer used to laugh and call him names. Mm-hmm. That was out of his past. And he thought that he would also give Rudolph this nose. And how are Jewish men usually made fun of? Because of their Jewish nose. And so you've got two aspects in there that came from his Jewish history. And now that you hear the song, you'll be able to pick that up. But it's things that we never knew before.
So it's not because Rudolph was an alcoholic and the red nose.
Well, the funny thing is that when he first did had his illustrator do Rudolph, he did it with a big shiny nose, and his bosses said, wait a minute, this nose is an alcoholic nose, and we're not going to have this in a children's book.
Oh, that's funny.
That's funny, yeah. So they made it little and shiny, and then it went ahead and it passed muster in the copywriting department. So he did it, and everybody was just fine with it. And when it came out in 1939, it was instantly a hit. They gave out 2.4 million copies.
Wow.
And they only stopped issuing it afterwards because of wartime restrictions on paper. And then when they resumed in 1946, it was even more popular. So here's what Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was like in its original form. 'Twas the day before Christmas, and all through the halls, the reindeer were playing, and all through the hills, I'm sorry, the reindeer were playing, enjoying the spills, skating and coasting and climbing the willows, and hopscotch and leapfrog protected by pillows. While every so often they'd stop to call names at one little deer not allowed in their games. Ha ha, look at Rudolph, his nose is a sight, it's red as a beet, twice as big, twice as bright, while Rudolph just wept. What else could he do? He knew that the things they were saying were true. And then it goes on, and you have the whole book, and you can still find it.
That's
printed
so
out
cool.
Online, and you can still find copies of it. But that came from his from his youth. Yeah, but remember, everything turns out okay.
Yeah.
So after he put out the book, his wife died, and he was left raising Barbara, his little four-year-old. And eventually, he got the rights to the book. Initially, Montgomery Ward had the rights, but because May had produced this and it was such a hit and he was going through a hard time, Montgomery Ward very generously gave him the rights, so he had all of the money, and the family still retains that.
That's pretty. It's not something you would see today.
Yeah. Now,
yeah,
Robert.
No kidding.
Here we go. Stay with me here. Robert May had a sister named Margaret. And Margaret met a young songwriter whose name was Johnny Marks. Johnny Marks began to look at the story of Rudolph and figured, you know what? This really might make a pretty good Christmas song. It needs a little changes here and there. But Johnny Marks took it, you know, and asked Bob May, how about it if I turn this into a song? And then if it's a hit, you know, it'll stay in the family and so forth. So Johnny Marks wrote it. Now, Johnny Marks was a songwriter born in 1909 in New York, and he was a secular Jewish guy, born into a secular Jewish family. He was a decorated World War II veteran who graduated from Colgate University, studied music at Columbia and in Paris, so he wasn't totally self-made, but he had his own style, and he began writing music at age 13. So by the time he met Margaret and married, he was establishing himself as a songwriter. So actually, he had been aware of the Rudolph story when it was published in 1939, and he was jotting some notes about it in a notebook that he kept for working on songs. And then the year after his marriage into the family, he began adding music once he got Bob's okay to do it, and he felt really he had a hit. So he did the song and presented it to Gene Autry, who at that point was a Western singing cowboy. And he was sort of not a rival, but there was Roy Rogers and then there were Gene Autry. Okay. They were both singing cowboys, but Marks thought that this would suit Gene Autry more than anyone else. So sure enough, Autry didn't like the song, but agreed to do it because his wife said, "It's for the kids, do it, do it." So he put it out as, in those days, records came out with an A side and a B side.
Yeah.
So they put it on the B side, and the B side became the hit, and nobody ever remembers what it happened to the A side. So that's how Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer became the second biggest hit of Christmas songs, and Johnny Marks went on to do Rock Around the Christmas Tree, Holly Jolly Christmas,
and
a lot more. He was a much more upbeat hip. So that's the story of Rudolph.
That's pretty cool.
Awesome story.
It took a little time to do it, but I thought everybody would enjoy hearing the story behind
it. It's really interesting there hearing the history of things that are so common in our holidays.
We have all these symbols and we don't know half of them. And it's the theme of the show today. We're trying to keep it positive. Speaking of origins, I'm going to tell you guys about the origins of mistletoe.
Ooh.
I'm excited.
Now, mistletoe is a plant that grows on a range of trees, including willow, apple, and oak trees. The tradition of hanging it in the house goes back to the times of the ancient Druids. It is supposed to possess mystical powers, which bring good luck to the household and wards off evil spirits. It was also used as a sign of love and friendship in Norse mythology, and that's where the custom of kissing under the mistletoe comes from.
Yeah, go Norse.
He was a Norse, yeah. So when the first Christians came to Western Europe, some tried to ban the use of mistletoe as a decoration in churches, but many still continue to use it. York Minster Church in the UK used to hold a special mistletoe service in the winter, where wrongdoers in the city of York could come and be pardoned. The custom of kissing under the mistletoe came from England. The original custom that was a berry was picked from the sprig of mistletoe before the person could be kissed, and when all the berries had gone, there could be no more kissing. So it's like pick a number almost, right?
Yeah.
So the name mistletoe came from two Anglo-Saxon words, which is mistel, which means dung.
What?
Yes. And tan, which means twig or stick. So you could translate mistletoe as poo on a stick.
Oh, my God.
Romance is in the air.
Oh, man. How many of us will now want to be kissed under the mistletoe?
Kiss me, I've got poo on a stick. So that's the origins of mistletoe. All right.
Wow.
Who wants to go?
Quite an evolution.
Yes, absolutely.
At least in the name.
Who wants to go next?
Only people knew.
Ooh, well, since we're doing the history of things, mm-hmm. I would love to talk about the history of Saturnalia and its influences on how we celebrate Christmas now. Okay. So, Saturnalia, it was a Roman holiday honoring the god of Saturn, which I didn't realize this. He's the god of sowing and seeds, which for us is kind of lame. But when you think about it, in Rome, that's a ridiculously important part of surviving.
Mm-hmm.
And originally, it was only held on December 17th. But then it was eventually increased to 3 days. And then eventually, after a while, it was actually increased to 7 whole days. So it continued to the 23rd. And so the different things they did was they obviously had lots of feasts. And all business and work was suspended during this holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing in Rome was that gambling was illegal during the whole year, except for Saturnalia, where gambling was allowed.
Oh.
So that was a huge thing that made people love this holiday, was that they could do this pastime that otherwise they couldn't do. And another part of Saturnalia that really made it just a really festive time was that they did role reversals.
Mm-hmm.
So during this time, slaves were given temporary freedom.
Uh-huh.
And to join in the festivities, and because work wasn't being done. So depending which, like, where you were, the slave would actually be given, like, the seat at the head of the table, and their masters would serve them, and they would take the role.
Role reversal.
Yeah, totally.
I get to beat you for a change.
Exactly. So I can probably assume that masters who weren't very nice to their slaves wouldn't do this because it would probably be a little sketchy because the slaves might be like, oh yeah, no, we're just gonna like murder you or something. And another really interesting thing they did was they would choose a mock king,
mm-hmm.
sometimes called the leader of Saturnalia or the lord of misrule. And one tradition that actually I've actually done that came from this mock king was they would hide a coin or a small object in a cake. And then they'd cut it up into pieces, and whoever got this small object would be the Lord of Misrule or the Mock King. And I've actually done this during a birthday party growing up.
Mm-hmm. Did you get the coin?
I didn't. But I had no idea that this is the roots of it. And yeah, so like that's a really interesting kind of thing that stuck through the culture. Another thing that they did was they would sacrifice a young pig at the Temple of Saturn, which is not uncustomary for old cultures to have sacrificed things. At least it wasn't a human. Which,
what do you mean? We still do it today, don't we?
Yeah, no? We do. I wouldn't say we take a live pig and like slit its throat.
We should bring that back.
Yeah, totally.
Have fun with that, Kevin.
Yeah.
We're doing this right after the show. We're sacrificing a goat or something.
Yeah. Another thing that they did at the end of Saturnalia, then the last day was called... I'm horrible with names, so I'm not even going to try to pronounce what this last day was called. But the last day is when they would do gift-giving. And so some common gifts they did were they would give wax models of fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Or...
wax molds of fruit?
Yeah, right.
That's kind of a cruel gift. I know, you think, right? You got an apple, you bite into it, it's wax.
I think that might have been the point.
Yeah, but it lasted all year, right?
Exactly. And they would also give wax statuettes. One common one was of Saturn himself. And it was this statue was commonly was bound at the feet by wooden cords, but during Saturnalia they would untie the cords. And then another thing they would do was give candles. And this actually has a really funny history, because originally there was like this prophecy in this one part of the Roman like area that it's really weird, but it basically people would give heads to Hades. And it said that Hercules was like basically told them that this one word that they were interpreting to mean heads could also mean light. So he was like, guys, why don't we do candles instead of heads?
Give heads.
So it's really funny how people have been like doing like, oh, hey, maybe let's not use like, this word could mean multiple things.
It's good to see that's not just the Christians that mistranslate everything.
Exactly. I thought that was something. Oh, my gosh. Go, Hercules. So from the 4th century, Christmas has kind of been like taking things from Saturnalia, and some of the things that have been absorbed into it. You might have picked them up. Gift giving. Mm-hmm. And singing carols was a common. They didn't do the carols, but that's something that we've taken from Saturnalia. Having feasts and coming together to eat meals together. Mm-hmm. General merrymaking is something we've taken. And lighting candles. And also how's being decorated with greenery and lights is something that has come from Saturnalia.
Yeah, you realize really quickly there's very little Christianity in Christmas.
Oh, there's
really
so little.
There really is very little of it.
And this is just Saturnalia. That's not talking about things coming from Celtic cultures and just everywhere. Like, there's so little that comes from Christian. Like, even saying that Jesus was born in Christmas, like, that 100% isn't true.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, most historians that research that think Jesus was born in like April.
Yeah.
Like Christmas is 100% pagan in like the date, things we do. It's really fascinating.
But it's just, you know, which is really wonderful in that there's so much diversity in Christmas. There's something about Christmas, I think, that everybody can enjoy. Of course, there's still, you know, the tension between, you know, having a secular holiday connected with a religious holiday. But if you just take Christmas and leave Christ out of Christmas,
it's
an amalgamation of a lot of different cultures, a lot of different beliefs and non-beliefs, and it's for children. There's a lot in there for everybody to enjoy. If the Christians would just keep their noses out of it, it'd be great.
And with Saturnalia, like even with the gift giving, they would specifically give gifts to children and poor people. So like even that, who we give gifts to.
Yeah.
Has roots in Saturnalia.
Yeah. Well, maybe that was mean to say of Christians. If Christians would just join in the secular part of it, maybe become more enthusiastic.
The truth is,
realizing the history of it, realizing that they don't own everything that's Christian.
Yeah. The truth is Christians culturally appropriated Saturnalia, called it Christmas, and did a wonderful job selling it as something they invented.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
All right. Are you done with that?
I am. That is everything I have on Saturnalia.
Okay, well.
No, I think it's great to review all of that that we realize,
the origins of
Christmas. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to tell you guys about, you were talking about caroling, so I'm going to tell you guys about the origins of caroling.
Great.
So the word carol actually means dance or song or praise and joy. Carols used to be written and sung during all 4 seasons, but only the tradition of singing them at Christmas has really survived. Early Christians took over the pagan solstice celebration for Christmas, which is exactly what you said, and gave people Christian songs to sing instead of pagan ones. That's what they did. That's what I was saying, right? They just took over the holiday and decided to make it their own. In 129, a Roman bishop said that a song called Angel Hymn should be sung at Christmas service in Rome. And another famous early Christmas hymn was written in 760 by Comas of Jerusalem for the Greek Orthodox Church. Soon after this, many composers all over Europe started writing Christmas carols. However, not many people liked them as they were all written and sung in Latin, which is obviously, you know, a language that the normal people couldn't understand.
Yep.
By the time of the Middle Ages, which was about the 1200s, most people had lost interest in celebrating Christmas altogether. This was changed by St. Francis of Assisi, when in 1223 he started his nativity plays in Italy. The people in the plays sang songs or cantiques that told the stories during the plays. Sometimes the choruses of these new carols were in Latin, but normally they were in all the languages that the people watching the play could understand and join in. The new carols spread to France, Spain, Germany, and other European countries. The earliest carols like this was written in 1410. Sadly, only a small fragment of it still exists today. The carol was about Mary and Jesus meeting different people in Bethlehem. Most carols from this time and the Elizabethan period are untrue stories, were loosely based on the Christmas story about the Holy Family and their entertaining rather than religious songs. They were usually sung in homes rather than in churches as well. So they were basically stories about the first Holy Family and, you know, Jesus trapped, I don't know, stepped on a mouse or something.
So well, when they personalize the stories,
exactly,
so people, yeah,
know,
so people would become more attached, you know.
It wasn't grandma that got run over by a reindeer at first; it was Joseph, and then they just switch it eventually. So, when Oliver Cromwell and the Puritans came to power in England in 1647, the celebration of Christmas and singing carols was stopped. However, the carols survived, and people still sang them in secret.
Oh my gosh.
It's kind of funny to say that, right? Carols remained mainly unsung until Victorian times, when two men called William Sandys and Davis Gilbert collected lots of old Christmas music from villages in England. Before carol singing in public became popular, they were sometimes official carol singers called waits. These were bands of people led by important local leaders, such as council leaders, who had the only power in the town and villages to take money from the public. If others did this, it was sometimes charged. They were charged as beggars, right? They were called waits because they only sang on Christmas Eve. So this was always sometimes known as Watch Night or Wait Night, because the shepherds were watching their sheep and the angels appeared to them when the Christmas celebration began. So that's the origins of caroling.
Oh. That's interesting.
All right.
Yeah. And I think that's, I really like that as a tradition when people go from house to house, and there really is something very festive and communal and enjoyable.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Do we have any in Canada that still
do? No, I've got a court order. I've got a court order that stops me from doing that. So, Kirsten, you got a story as well.
I do have a story, and it is why did NORAD start tracking Santa?
Oh, that's a good story.
Good story.
All right. On December 24th, 1955, the red telephone at the Continental Air Defense Command Operations Center in Colorado Springs, Colorado, began ringing. The red phone meant it was either the Pentagon or CONAD, Commander-in-Chief General Earl Partridge, on the other end, and the reason for calling would probably not be pleasant. U.S. Air Force Colonel Henry Shoup, Director of Operations at the center, rushed over to the phone and grabbed it. "Yes, sir, this is Colonel Shoup," he barked. Nothing but silence in response. "Sir, this is Colonel Shoup," he said. Silence again. "Sir, can you read me all right?" Finally, a soft voice on the other end. "Are you really Santa Claus?" a little girl asked.
Oh my gosh.
Shoup was stunned for a second. This must be a joke, he thought. He looked around the room, expecting to see his men laughing at their prank, but found stony, serious faces all around. He realized that there was some screw-up on the phones and decided to play along. "Yes, I am," he answered. "Have you been a good little girl?"
That's wonderful.
The girl explained to Shoup that she would leave some food out for both Santa and his reindeer, and then recited her Christmas list to him. Shoup thanked her for her hospitality, noting that Santa had a lot of traveling to do. "How did he get to all those houses in one night anyway?" she asked. Apparently that was classified intelligence in Shoup's mind. "That's the magic of Christmas," he said. "If anyone asks her about that, he said, "she should tell them to stop asking so many questions or Santa would put them on the naughty list."
Now drop down and do 10 push-ups.
Yep. That red phone boy, Shoop later recalled. That's either the old man, the four-star General Partridge, or the Pentagon. I was all shook up. The red phone would keep ringing throughout the night, not because of Soviet nukes or fighter planes heading toward U.S. soil, but because of a typo. That day, Shoop would later learn a local newspaper ran a Sears Roebuck ad inviting kids to contact Santa. "Hey, kiddies," the ad read. "Call me on my private phone, and I will talk to you personally anytime, day or night." The ad listed Santa's direct line, but the number in the copy was off by a single digit.
You know what that means? That means the guy they hired to play Santa on the other line
was like, nobody's calling.
Nobody called at all. This guy's waiting all night.
That's actually kind of sad.
It is. It is. Instead of connecting to the special line Sears set up with the Santa impersonator, kids wound up calling a secret air defense emergency number.
Oh my gosh.
After a few more Santa-related calls, Shoop pulled a few airmen aside and gave them a special assignment. They would answer the phone and give callers, barring the Pentagon, we assume, Santa's current location as they tracked him on their radar.
Oh my gosh.
From that night on, tracking Santa became a yearly tradition carried on by the North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, when it replaced CONAD in 1958. A new phone number separate from the red phone was established and publicized, and people were invited to call in and find out how close Santa was to their home. Every Christmas Eve, military service members, staff phones and email accounts, and the Santa Tracker Twitter account to keep kids up to date on Santa's whereabouts. Harry Shoop passed away in 2009, remembered by his peers and the public as the Santa Colonel who gave a special gift to millions of kids.
Aww.
That is such an amazing story.
That is a great story. I love how they're using Twitter now.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those others where something happens accidentally that was far better than anything else that could have happened.
You could not have planned that.
You could,
like,
you know.
What are the chances that that number was one digit off from the red phone?
Exactly.
What are the odds? I mean, he totally could have, when that first little girl called, he totally could have said,
"No,
get off this line. You know, this is, you know."
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Secret, blah, blah, and just hang up.
Could you imagine if that happened now? They'd send out, like, SWAT to the kid's house.
Yeah, they probably would.
Maybe.
Although it has happened at other times when they got the wrong number.
Oh my gosh.
Not specifically with Christmas, but I've seen stories where it's happened.
Yeah.
Like calling the CIA.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Yeah, he must have had children of his own to where he, probably. You know. He,
I would imagine
yeah,
so.
Exactly. Although he could have been a good uncle to some as well. No, it's just the whole thing came together in a really magical, nice way.
Mm-hmm. And then to put people on staff for that phone to tell, give them the tracker, and then they start this whole tracking them. Like,
oh, great PR, you know, just great PR.
They could have just done it that one night and then,
exactly.
You know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, I'm going to tell you guys about the origins of the Christmas tree.
Okay.
So this could be interesting. So the evergreen fir tree has traditionally been used to celebrate winter festival, pagan and Christian, for thousands of years. Pagans used the branches of it to decorate their home during the winter solstice, as it made them think of the spring to come. The Romans used the fir trees to decorate their temples in the festival of Saturnalia, like you were saying. Christians use it as a sign of everlasting life with God. Nobody's really sure when the fir tree were first used as Christmas trees. It probably began about 1,000 years ago in Northern Europe. Many early Christmas trees seem to have been hung upside down from the ceiling, almost like a chandelier.
I want to do that
How
now.
How did it get... What?
Well, they had a hook up there, right? So they would put it but upside down like a chandelier.
That's funny.
So then the squirrel would fall on you after that. So... Other Christmas trees, early Christmas trees across many parts of Northern Europe, were cherry or hawthorn plants, or a branch of the plant, that were put into pots and brought inside so they would hopefully flower at Christmas time.
Aww.
If you could afford the real plant, people made pyramids of wood. If you couldn't afford a real plant, people would make pyramids of wood, and they were decorated to look like a tree with paper, apples, and candles.
Oh my gosh.
Sometimes they were carried around from house to house rather than being displayed in a home. It's possible that the wooden pyramid trees were meant to be like a paradise trees. They were used in medieval German mystery or miracle plays that were acted out in front of churches on Christmas Eve. In early church calendars of saints, the 24th of December was Adam and Eve's day, and the paradise tree represents the Garden of Eden. It was often paraded around the town before the play started as a way of advertising the play. The play told the Bible stories, of course, to people that could not read. The first documented use of a Christmas tree in New Year's celebration is argued between two cities, the city of Tallinn in Estonia and Riga in Latvia. Both claim that they had the first tree. Tallinn claims 1441 and Riga claims 1510. Both trees were put up by the Brotherhood of Blackheads, which was an association of local unmarried merchants, ship owners, and foreigners in Livonia, which is now Estonia and Latvia. Little is known about either tree, apart that they were put in the town square, were danced around by the Brotherhood of Blackheads, and were then set on fire. This is like the custom of the Yule log. The word used for the tree could also mean a mast or pole. The tree might have been like a paradise tree or a tree-shaped wooden candelabra, rather than a real tree. In the town square of Riga, the capital of Latvia, there is a plaque which engraved the first New Year's tree in Riga is 1510 in 8 languages that you can find about more if you ever visit that place. A picture from Germany in 1521, which shows a tree being paraded around streets with a man riding a horse behind it. The man is dressed as a bishop, probably representing St. Nicholas. In 1584, the historian Balthazar Rousseau wrote about a tradition in Riga of a decorated fir tree in the market square where the young man went with a flock of maidens and women. First sang and danced, and then they would set the tree on fire.
Oh my gosh.
They would set the tree on fire.
Don't need this anymore.
There is a record of a small tree in Brandmen, Germany, from 1570, and it's described as a tree decorated with apple, nuts, dates, pretzels, and a paper flower.
Well, I guess setting the tree on fire, I mean, it was winter, and it's just like a bonfire.
Maybe, yeah.
You know, so maybe, you know, part of it was setting the tree on fire and then, you know, standing around the tree and
roasting,
you know,
marshmallows,
warming your hands and things.
The first person to bring a Christmas tree to the house, in the way we know it today, may have been 16th century German preacher Martin Luther. The story is told that one night before Christmas, he was walking through the forest and looked up at the stars shining through the branches. It was so beautiful that he went home and told his children that it reminds him of Jesus, blah, blah, blah. And he decided to put a tree inside. The custom of having Christmas trees could have traveled along the Baltic Sea from Latvia to Germany. In Germany, the first Christmas trees were decorated with edible things such as gingerbread and gold-covered apple.
Ooh.
Yeah. Then glassmakers made special small ornaments similar to some of the decorations used today. In 1605, an unknown German wrote, "At Christmas they set up fir trees in the parlors of Strasbourg and hang thereon roses cut of many colored paper, apples, wafers, gold foil, sweets, etc." At first, a figure of the baby Jesus was put on top of the tree. Over time, it changed into an angel or fairy and that told the shepherds about Jesus, or a star, like the one the wise men saw. The first Christmas tree came to Britain somewhere in the 1830s. They became very popular in 1841 when Prince Albert, which was Queen Victoria's German husband, had a Christmas tree set up in Windsor Castle. In 1848, a drawing on the Queen's Christmas tree at Windsor Castle was published in the Illustrated London News. The drawing was republished in Gaudy's Lady's Book, Philadelphia, in December 1850, but they removed it. They removed the Queen's crown and Prince Albert's mustache to make it look more American.
Oh my gosh!
The publication of the drawing helped Christmas trees become popular in the UK and the US. So that's how we know. That's how we got
the
Christmas tree.
That's so cool.
Yeah, and then they ended up over here, and which is great. And then unfortunately went to the artificial aluminum trees, but that's okay. When my kids were little, we owned a owned a house, and I hated to put anything dead, like dead flowers or dead trees. So what we would do is we would get a tree from the nursery, and it would still be in the container.
Yes.
So we'd decorate it, and then we'd have a planting ceremony.
That's what we want to do eventually. Which is,
a good way to do it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're wonderful. I liked Christmas.
I just wear the decorations myself.
Oh, my gosh. I grew up...
Here we go.
My family loved Christmas. And my aunt did, like, an open house. And so we put up thousands upon thousands of Christmas lights outside.
Didn't you guys get up to, like, 80,000?
Oh, God, no. Not that much.
No, 79,000.
50. I think 50,000 was the most we did. But inside, every single room, including bathrooms, had a Christmas tree.
Oh, wow.
And it was a big house. I think we got like 13 Christmas trees in her house.
Could you just put like a...
And they were all themed.
It was
amazing.
Could you put like a pine air freshener instead in the bathroom? No. That would have made more sense.
It was fun, though, because we had to start October 1st.
Yep.
Putting up Christmas decorations. So, yeah, Christmas has always been a really big part of my life.
Oh, man. Unpacking the decorations and then repacking.
Oh, my aunt had a whole system. Like, it was all, like, every box was numbered. She had, like, a master
has
list.
It
was amazing.
Did you enjoy it, or was it a chore?
I loved it.
Oh, well, then that's worth it if you enjoy it. Yeah,
October 1st, we turn on the Christmas music and start unpacking and dance around. It was fun.
Cool. All right. The next little story actually is still yours.
Yes, it is.
Okay. All right. Next little positive story.
So this, I heard like the kind of like, I've never really heard a lot about this, but I heard the basics of it years ago. I think I was in like elementary school when I first heard about this. And it's always really made me realize how just decent humans can be. So this is a story about the Christmas truce in World War I. So this was between the British and German troops meeting in no man's land. And it was an unofficial truce. So there was roughly 100,000 British and German troops that were involved in the So they weren't fighting each other.
Ceasefire?
Well, no, it's a cessation. I just can't say that. Okay. Can't say that word.
Cessation?
There we go. And it was along the Western Front. So the first truce started on Christmas Eve in November. My God.
Yeah, that's a different Christmas.
Christmas Eve in 1914, when the German troops decorated the area around their trenches in the region of the... Yeah, blah, blah.
Ypres?
There we go. French word. In Belgium. Particularly in Saint-Yvon, where Captain Bruce Bairn's father described the truce. The Germans placed candles on their trenches and on Christmas trees, then continued the celebration by singing Christmas carols. The British responded by singing carols of their own. The two sides continued by shouting Christmas greetings at each other. Soon thereafter, there were excursions across no man's land, where small gifts were exchanged, such as food, tobacco, and alcohol, and souvenirs such as buttons and hats. Our artillery in the region fell silent. The truce also allowed a breathing spell where recently killed soldiers were brought back behind their lines by burial parties. Joint services were held in many sections. The truce lasted through Christmas night, continuing until New Year's Day and others. On Christmas Day, Brigadier General Walter Congreve, then commanding the 18th Infantry Brigade, stationed near French word. I swear I'm not.
Spell it.
N-E-U-V-E.
Neuville?
Neuville-Chapelle.
Oh, Neuville-Chapelle?
There we go.
Neuville-Chapelle?
He's French.
Okay.
wrote a letter recalling the Germans initiated by calling a truce for the day. One of his brigade's men bravely lifted his head above the parapet, and others from both sides walked onto no man's land.
Officers and other men shook hands and exchanged cigarettes and cigars. One of his captains smoked a cigar with the best shot in the German army. The latter no more than 18 years old. Congreve admitted he was reluctant to personally witness the scene of the truce for fear he would be a prime target for German snipers. Future nature writer Henry Williamson, then a 19-year-old private in the London Rifle Brigade, wrote to his mother on Boxing Day. "Dear Mother, I am writing from the trenches. It is 11 o'clock in the morning. Beside me is a coke fire. Opposite me, a dugout with straw in it. The ground is sloppy in the actual trench, but frozen elsewhere. In my mouth is a pipe presented by the Princess Mary. In the pipe is tobacco. Of course, you say, but wait, in the pipe is German tobacco. Ha ha, you say. From a prisoner or found in a captured trench? Oh dear, no. From a German soldier? Yes, a live German soldier from his own trench. Yesterday, the British and Germans met and shook hands in the ground between the trenches and exchanged souvenirs and shook hands. Yes, all day Xmas Day. And as I write, marvelous, isn't it?" Captain Sir Edward Hussle reported how the first interpreter he met from the German lines was from Suffolk, where he had left his girlfriend and a 3.5 HP motorcycle. Hussle went on to describe a sing-song which ended up with Auld Lang Syne, which we all, English, Scot, Irish, Persian, Wolltenbergers, etc., joined in. It was absolutely astounding, and if I had seen it on a cinematograph film, I should have sworn it was faked. Captain Robert Patrick Miles, who was attached to the Royal Irish Rifles, called in an edited letter that was published in both the Daily Mail and the Wellington Journal and Shrewsbury's News in January 1915, following his death in action on December 30th, 1914. "Friday, Christmas Day. We are having the most extraordinary Christmas Day imaginable. A sort of unarranged and quite unauthorized but perfectly understood and scrumptiously observed truce exists between us and our friends in front. The funny thing is it only seems to exist in this part of the battle line. On our right and left, we can all hear them firing away as cheerfully as ever. The thing started last night, a bitter cold night, with white frost. Soon after dusk, when the Germans started shouting, 'Merry Christmas! Merry Christmas, Englishmen,' to us. Of course, our fellows shouted back, and presently large numbers of both sides had left their trenches, unarmed, and met in the debatable shot-riddled no-man's land between the lines. Here, the agreement, all on their own, came to be made that we should not fire at each other until after midnight tonight. The men were all fraternizing in the middle. We naturally did not allow them close to our lines, and swapped cigarettes and lies in the utmost good fellowship. Not a shot was fired all night." Of the Germans, he wrote, "They are distinctly bored with the war. In fact, one of them wanted to know what on earth we were doing here fighting them." The truce in that sector continued on to Boxing Day. He commented about the Germans, "The beggars simply disregarded all our warnings to get down from off their parapet. So things are at a deadlock. We can't shoot them in cold blood. I can't see how we can get them to return to business." On Christmas Eve and Christmas Day in 1914, Alfred Anderson's unit of the 1st and 5th Battalion of the Black Watch was billeted in a farmhouse away from the front line. In a later interview in 2003, Anderson, the last known surviving Scottish veteran of the war, vividly recalled Christmas Day and said, "I remember the silence, the eerie sound of silence. Only the guards were on duty. We all went outside the farm building and just stood listening. And of course, thinking of people back at home, All I'd heard for 2 months in the trenches was the hissing, cracking, and whistling or whining of bullets in flight, machine gun fire, and distant German voices. But there was a dead silence that morning. Right across the land, as far as you could see, we shouted Merry Christmas, even though nobody felt merry. The silence ended early in the afternoon, and the killing started again. It was a short peace in a terrible war. Nor were the observations confirmed to the British, or confined to the British. French Lieutenant Johannes Niemann wrote, "Grabbed my binoculars and looked cautiously over the parapet. Saw the incredible sight of our soldiers exchanging cigarettes, schnapps, and chocolate with the enemy." General Sir Horace Smith Doran commented, "A commander of the British Second Corps issued orders forbidding friendly communications with the opposing German troops."
Forbidding.
Forbidding.
Wow.
Oh, this is such an unfortunate name to have in this. Adolf Hitler, then a young corporal of the 16th, Bavarian Reserve Infantry, was also an opponent of the truce. Can't understand why.
Hitler had no Christmas spirit?
Apparently.
Wow. You think, like, he sounds kind of like a bad guy. We should keep an eye on this guy.
I know, right? In the coal mines sector of the front, there was an early fraternization between German and French soldiers in December of 1914 during a short truce. And there are at least two other testimonials from French soldiers of similar behaviors in sections where German and French companies opposed each other. Gervas Morlin wrote to his parents, "The Boches waved a white flag and shouted, 'Comrades, comrades, rendezvous. When we don't move, they came toward us unarmed, led by an officer. Although we are not clear what they are... Oh, sorry. Although we are not clean, they are disgustingly filthy. I am telling you this, but don't speak of it to anyone. We must not mention it even to other soldiers." Gustave Barthier wrote, "On Christmas Day, the Boches made a sign showing they wished to speak to us. They said they didn't want to shoot. They were tired of making war. They were married like me. They didn't have any differences from the French, but with the English." In sections of the front, the Germans and Belgians troops faced each other on December 1914. There was at least one instance where a truce was achieved at the request of Belgian soldiers who wished to send letters back to their families over the German-occupied parts of their country. In the lead-up to Christmas 1914, there were several peace initiatives. The Open Christmas Letter was a public message of peace addressed to the women of Germany and Austria, signed by a group of 101 British women suffragettes at the end of 1914, as the first Christmas of World War I approached. Pope Benedict XV, on the 7th of December 1914, had begged for an official truce between the warring governments. He asked that the guns may fall silent, at least upon the night the angels sang. This attempt was officially rebuffed. And that is all I have about the Christmas.
It's you have to wonder, of 1914. When... these soldiers came together, and of course they were trained to fight, and they were patriotic and all that kind of stuff. But you really wonder, after exchanging that and seeing
that they were human,
how could they then resume? You know, thanks for the tobacco in my pipe, bang, you're dead.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, humans are so complex, aren't they?
Well, it just goes to show that war is really probably the ultimate human stupidity, because deep down inside, no matter how much you hate your enemy, he or she goes home at night and has essentially the same life you have. You know, they want to go home to their family, they want to go home to their kids, you know, and when you realize there's really not that much of a difference between your culture and theirs, and
especially
your language
when,
and theirs.
When you realize they were fighting over nothing.
Yeah.
In World War One. It was nothing.
They were the soldiers. They were commanded to fight because the leaders of their country decided they had, you know, disagreements that couldn't be solved any other way. So that's what soldiers do. Yeah. And it's
exactly.
just, they're the fodder, you know.
So, cool.
Yeah. Great story.
Yes, it's a beautiful story.
Absolutely.
I just love how they, like, people were just like, you know what, it's Christmas. Let's just not kill each other today, please.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you could extend that.
I know, right?
You know, of course, the Christians are going to see that's the power of Jesus and all that, but I think it's just the power of the human heart.
Yeah.
You know, there's no mystery in this, you know. I mean, at some point, people get tired of fighting, especially
yeah.
when you're in the trench, you're in the mud,
and
you realize...
And especially when you aren't fighting for anything.
Yes.
Like, in World War II, I don't think that could happen because they were actually fighting for, like, something. Like, there was a massive reason for the war. World War One was kind of a shitty reason.
Yeah.
Like, it was... There's no, like,
I imagine
they were
soldiers could have sat down in the trenches and made a peace accord between them right then and there.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
could have been much better than...
Yeah, probably anything better than their government came up with.
Yeah.
So, cool. Excellent. Well, thank you, guys. Thank you so much for this. Do you guys want to quickly go as to any quirky tradition you guys have at your own place?
The past few years, for me, I always work on Christmas.
Oh. Yeah.
Pals don't take holidays, and I always work on Christmas, so I've actually been doing everything on Christmas Eve.
Our Christmas is Christmas
Eve.
Yeah,
which is super fun, because we get it a day early.
Well, you know, the funny thing is I was raised like that.
Really?
Yeah, to do the thing to sleep at night and wait till the 25th in the morning to open gifts is... I never grew up with that at all. We were always opening gifts on the 24th at
midnight.
That's
so awesome. Oh, you opened it at midnight?
Yes. It was called
a
réveillon.
That's so fun.
What would happen is you would...
Is it a Catholic thing?
I think it's just a European thing.
Are you sure?
Yeah,
because I know other Catholics that do that.
Yeah, my girlfriend of mine is... she's Italian, and they celebrate it the same way, too.
Oh, cool.
And it was, you know, you send the kids to bed early so they can get some rest because you don't want them up the whole time.
Yep.
And then shortly before midnight, you wake them up and everybody comes downstairs and everybody tears apart the gifts and all that. And, you know, they play with it a bit. And then we'd have this huge feast.
That is so
in
fun.
In the wee hours of the morning.
And then you pass out.
And then you pass out. And then you pass out.
So you didn't wait for Santa Claus and the reindeer to
prance
on the roof.
24 at midnight, Santa Claus had gone by already.
I have a funny story about Santa growing up.
Okay,
before we get to that,
okay.
Another thing that we do is we've decided since we moved in together, every year, you know the Hallmark ornaments that they come out with every year?
Yeah.
We decide every year we're going to get a new one of those.
Guess
and our
what
first,
we got this year?
Our first one was
Beauty and the
Beast.
Oh.
Guess what we got this year?
Jeez.
Just guess.
You're lucky I was in the mall that day.
Does it start with an H?
It
does.
It's totally Harry Potter.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Harry Houdini.
Yeah.
No. It's totally. It's Harry Potter.
It is Harry Potter.
Of course.
But with growing up, because my family was really religious, they told me that Santa wasn't real when I was, like, 5.
How cruel is that?
Well, they actually just never told me Santa, like, was a thing.
Okay.
And they told me, they explained, like, the history of, like, Saint Nick and stuff. I didn't realize that all children were not informed of this.
Oh, God.
So I...
You went around and told kids?
Kindergarten. I can remember being on the bus. First week of school to a boy in my class, being like, Santa's not real. No, he's not real. We had a massive argument on the bus where I'm just trying to, like, because I didn't understand how this child could believe in Santa. Because I'm like, wait, no, what do you, that makes no sense. It's not real.
And the irony is so thick there because at the time you believed in Jesus.
Right? I know.
It's so thick.
My aunt had to sit me down and be like, okay, some parents tell their children this is real and you can't go doing that. That is not.
I can just picture Auntie sitting you, little 5-year-old you down and telling you that.
Oh, it's such a funny memory. Oh, I love it.
I know when my daughter found out that Santa wasn't real, and she found out a bit late too, and oh, she was so angry at me.
I actually don't like it when you string kids along. Like, I personally, if I ever had kids, I wouldn't, like, straight out tell them Santa's not real. but I don't think I'd, like, make it this big thing.
No, oh, yeah.
And also, PSA, don't give your kids amazing presents from Santa.
Yes.
Yeah.
Give them, like, the little dinky toys from Santa, and have the awesome presents from you as a parent, or, like, an aunt or something.
Or the cats.
Yeah, because when kids go to school and, like, oh, look what Santa got me. He got me a Nintendo Switch. And this other kid who's from a poor family is like, oh, Santa got me a Slinky.
Yeah.
What did I do wrong?
Yep.
Yeah, I think Santa's got a limited budget, you know?
My favorite Christmas tradition is actually stockings.
Really?
I love stockings.
I didn't grow up with that at all.
Growing up?
Barely.
Because I have a lot of siblings, every kid got a step that the stocking hung on. We had 13 steps, so we just fit on it. And growing up, stockings were the only thing that everybody got the exact same thing with. So I'm a socialist, as everyone can probably guess by that. I'm not, like, a democratic socialist, people. But
she's a commie.
Totally. No, I'm not. But growing up, other than the stockings, there was a massive disparity in the quality of presents my family gave, because Christmas was the time of year all of my cousins came together. So I had a ridiculously close family. Mm-hmm. And there was another family that had 6 kids in my extended family, so cousins. And they would get, like, 20 presents for Christmas, and, like, really nice presents, like cameras and laptops.
Yeah.
And I would get, like, 3 things. And growing up, it really stuck a blow.
It did, to
my, like, self-esteem. And be like, wait, did my parents not love me?
Yeah.
Because when you're a kid, you think the presents are, like, a ranking of how much people love you.
Especially when you know that the cousin of yours that's getting 20 gifts is a brat.
Well, no. Some of them were. But, like, it was actually a couple years ago that it really hit home, because I was sitting right beside my favorite cousin, who is the youngest. We're both the youngest of their separate families.
Yeah.
And I got 3 presents, and one of them was, like, a teddy. And, like, they were just, like, really, like, I think one was a pair of earrings. And he got 23 presents.
Yeah.
And they were, like, amazing presents. And I just remember, because we were both saving our presents till we all got them. Because there's a gajillion presents under the tree. Because I have, like, there's, like, 50 people in the extended family.
Holy Jesus.
So I think the most that ever visit was that we had to rent a hall 1 year to have dinner. Because there was 2 people to fit in the house. Yeah.
Big and that's family. Impressive when you look at how Auntie squeezes everyone in the house.
Yeah. And so at the end, like, my cousin had this massive stack of presents. And I just had, like, this little stack. And it made me, that was when I realized how much, like, presents, like, I interpreted presents.
Yeah.
And realized how much I hate presents. But I love giving presents to kids, because kids are really the only people who need presents.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Christmas can be such a defining holiday. You know, listening to Christina, it can be such a defining holiday that affects the rest of your life in a lot of ways.
Well, especially when Christmas is, because in my family, Christmas was always built up as this time you come together and show love and, you know, you spend time with people you love, and presents were always a big part of that. So you couldn't just separate presents from this feeling of love and caring. So then when you didn't get that, you were like, wait a second, something's not right here.
Well, if it's any consolation, dear, I think of all of you as gifts to me.
Oh, okay.
So. Aw.
So.
Yeah. In my house, it was always a... How many of those maraschino cherry chocolates did Grandpa get Grandma this year?
Oh, my gosh.
Like I said to my grandma a month ago, I'm like, Grandma, why are you buying them? You know he's going to get you a stack.
Yep. And
she just loved them.
Jumping back to the me interpreting presents, I think it also might be impacted by the fact I am a twin.
Mm-hmm.
So growing up, everything had to be equal between my twin and I, like, to an obsessive level. Like, if we were driving, if someone of us got to sit in the front seat of the car, my mom had to stop halfway and let us switch.
Wow.
Yeah.
Could you just switch on the way back?
It depends. Sometimes we did that.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh my goodness, we can go on and on and on and on, and on, yeah. and on about Christmas.
I think that also was an impact to how I interpreted fairness.
You're so used to things being always fair, having to be equal.
And I think that's another reason why I loved stalking.
So the show next week is going to be a look into the psyche of Christina.
I think that would cover a few shows, Kevin. Like, if we have anything we have to fill in.
Let me talk about my job. Yeah. There we go.
We'll go from year one. On the couch. Year two.
On the couch with
Christina. Anyway, it's fun to learn all of these things, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, geez. Okay, well, thank you guys so much for being with us on the show today. You can follow us on leftatvalley.com. You can send us an email at leftatvalley@outlook.com. You can follow us on Facebook, on Twitter, at LETV Podcast. And you can also follow our sister show, So You Think You're a Skeptic, with our friend Tyler and Kevin.
Amazing. This is the last show of this year,
isn't it? No, we still got the next show.
Oh, that's right. Another one?
Which I was about to say.
Oh, okay.
Next week, we're doing the best.
I'm a little premature, am I not?
You just want to go on vacation. Yeah. Next week, we're doing the best of the year, the top 10 shows that we had during the year.
I wonder how many of them I'm involved with, because I wasn't here all last year.
Well, yeah. Probably most of them, actually.
Really?
Oh, I have a quick question for everybody. What's one of your favorite Christmas movies?
Oh, jeez.
For me, Die Hard.
That's really easy for me. The original Miracle on 34th Street.
The black and white one.
The black and white.
Oh, wow.
Mine's Home Alone, hands down. I love watching the birth of Jigsaw.
I thought it was Godzilla versus King Kong. For me.
Actually, I have a modern one too, Elf. I think between those two, I love them.
I've seen that movie more times in French class than I have any other time.
I love Elf.
I know for me, it's Arthur Christmas.
Yeah. That is
or Annabelle's Wish.
Also a great movie.
Yes.
So anyway, like I said, next week we're doing the top 10 of the year. And in the coming year, we'll have our friend Damian Gillis is going to come talk to us about wild salmon. We'll also be talking about biomimicry.
I'm so excited for that one.
And we'll also have our friend David Fitzgerald come to talk to us in February about his new book, as well as Michael Shermer. We're still setting a date for that. And here's something that's very interesting. You know, we've been talking about Barry Neufeld.
Yep.
So somewhere in February, we've invited Dr. Drance and Dr. Del Rey to come back to the show, and we'll probably do it live somewhere, probably at the stage in Mission. We've got a friend that's going to help us do that, and we're going to put this LGBTQ trans thing to rest once and for all.
Sounds good.
So that should be fun. So keep an eye on that. We'll have some fun with that. Okay. Well, thank you.
We always
have
fun.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to all. And we're going to leave you guys with, we're talking about the Christmas tree. So let's
listen to Harry Potter Christmas music.
No.
It exists. It actually exists.
We're just going to put the Happy Christmas, War is Over by John Lennon. Until next time, guys.
Hey, it wouldn't be the end of the show if I didn't talk about Harry Potter.
That's true.
So this is Christmas.
This is such a good song.
And what have you done? Another year over. And you won't just be gone. And so this is so happy.